This is Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston, and you're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5 FM and 92.5 FM in good old McLean County and Bloomington Normal. Also 88.3 in Pontiac and 97.1 in Lincoln, all in good old Central Illinois. And I'm here with my wife, Lynn, today. We're going to have a great show for you. And before we start, I'll ask Lynn, is there anything that you want to say before we get started? Maybe we'll recap a little bit about what we did last week, but I'll let you go ahead and take it for now just to make sure that I defer to you and don't exclude you in any way. I want to have peace at home and make sure that everything goes well that way.
Boy, you're laying it out there, aren't you?
I guess I am today.
You're putting your neck on the line, aren't you?
It must be this cool, cool weather.
Yeah.
It is so nice and sort of makes you bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Makes you want to, like, clean the windows. And
uh-oh. I see what she's driving at. Let's change the subject. And is there anything?
The carpeting needs to be shampooed. You want the list?
Is there anything you want to talk about what we did last week or anything you want to add?
No, I think it was a delightful opportunity to be able to talk to Sister Rachel last week and to get a young person's view of what's going into religious life is like. We have a lot to be thankful for these young women that go into religious life, and the men too that go in, the young men and join the brothers and the monks and so forth. They're too few going in, really, but it's a peaceful life, but you have to have that obedience that comes, that religious obedience. That's, I think, a single thing, but she did a wonderful job. And you know, if the young people give up everything in their lives and their future to serve God and to serve us. And we need to be thankful, especially for our priests. They do. They give up everything, too. They have no life other than the church.
That's true. And while we're on that subject, I want to remind everybody out there, if you can, make a donation to Catholic Spirit Radio. We bring you Catholic programming 24/7 and EWTN. And it takes a lot to do this, and everybody here does this all gratis. You know, everybody at the station is giving everything they can to help bring good Catholic radio to all the listeners out there. So if you can, especially during the summer months here, you know, make a donation, and you can go to our website, and that's CatholicSpiritRadio.com. Again, that's CatholicSpiritRadio.com. If you would like to find out more information about us, you can find it there, and you can also make a donation there. We do have a phone number also, 309-807-2427. Again, that's 309-807-2427. So if you're able to do that, we would really appreciate, you know, anything that you could do and help us out to get through these sort of dry months of the summer and into the fall, which
fall
of course
season,
is starting
yes.
now.
Also, I'd like to put in a little reminder that Spirit Radio is backing or promoting a trip to the Holocaust Museum in Chicago on September 7th and spend the day up there. It should be very, very interesting, especially in a time when people seems to be among some people denial that the Holocaust ever happened. We need to keep that in mind.
Yeah, and it's so close by, right, you know, right very near us in Chicago. It doesn't take long to get up there, long to get back. So it will be a great trip. So if you have a chance, find out more about that, go to our website, CatholicSpiritRadio.com. And again, we're going to have a great show for you today. But speaking of last week, did you see, Lynn, the Catholic Post, last week's post?
Yes, I did. There's an excellent article in there about a young lady wanting to order join the Salesian Sisters, but because of the financing that the money she borrowed from for her college education, she can't enter until it's paid for.
Yeah.
I mean, she has won $150,000.
$139,000
in debt, and she has to pay that down to $16,000 before they'll accept her.
Yeah, she's another one from down in, you know, Champaign. Going to school in Champaign. I guess the sisters attracted her attention as well. Her name's Pamela Soreska. You can find out more about her by looking at the post if you get the Catholic Post.
Going online and picking it up.
Yeah, I think she's got a website or something. But if you probably go to that name, Pamela Suresca, that's S-U-R-E-S-C-A. And she actually is from, I was reading in that article, about 15 miles away from Hallidon, I guess is the name of the town, New Jersey, where the Daughters of Mary, Help of Christians, have their convent, I guess. And so she grew up right near there. I don't know if she knew it was there when she was growing up or, you know, found out about it when she was here, you know, in Champaign or what the case is. But it's sort of interesting that we had a sister, you know, Rachel on talking all about that. And then all of a sudden in that, you know, the last Saturday's Post, there was the article about this young lady also down in Champaign. So I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, she's raised from private donations about $50,000 already, which will really ease some of that burden. But the order can't take on that burden of everybody's educational loans. So that's why they have that in place. But they have to pay for them. Even to go into the priesthood or any religious life, your no loans, your school loans or whatever have to be paid down as much as possible.
But at any rate, we'll go ahead and pick up again what we were doing before we interviewed Sister Rachel, and we were talking, we were covering Joseph Pierce's book, Literature, What Every Catholic Should Know, and we're going to go ahead and take that up again this week and continue on with it.
Where are we starting this week?
Okay, we're going to start with Dante. Last week we finished up with Beowulf, and Beowulf, you know, represented early Christian literature, and so we're going to, you know, start with Dante, and because for Catholics especially, Dante, you know, was in Rome. Of course, Dante was Italian, and the that goes back to Rome. The setting for Dante, I think, was around the 1200s in Rome. But at any rate, Beowulf was set in about 700, 800 AD. We don't know who wrote Beowulf. I do want to mention that, you know, it was an allegory, and we talked about allegories the week before last when we did Beowulf, and there are some of our Christian brothers and sisters who deny that there's allegory in the Bible, and there certainly is. They may be talking about formal allegory, and that's when something is so abstract that it doesn't really stand on its own as its own story. It's just a total abstraction, and it stands for something else. That kind of allegory is not in the Bible, but there are plenty of allegories in the Bible. That is comparing one thing to another, you know, one thing pointing at something else, just like we said, the parable, you know, of the prodigal son, when Christ is talking about, we're not necessarily talking about a real person who exactly lived or anything, but the prodigal son represents, in effect, us, how we fall away and so forth. So in other words, there is a lot of allegory in the Bible, you know, in some of the parables and just in other stories all through the Bible. So there certainly is allegory in it. And the allegory, of course, in Beowulf was sort of the allegory between Beowulf's group going out after Grendel the monster, and the apostles, in effect, and Christ fighting, you know, the Romans. And all of those represent Satan, you know, good versus evil. So those are the allegories there.
And it seems to me that the story, Beowulf, would be very attractive to young people, especially young boys, going after the monster.
It is, because it's a story of young men going out, you know, and becoming growing up, you know, being tested and so forth in battle. And we have the, you know, we end our program with the battle, you know, St. Michael the Archangel, defend us in battle. And, there, you know, this life is not only a story, it's a battle. And we're at it all the time. Good versus evil, it exists in every age. And that's what great literature talks about. And that's why we're talking about good literature. If you have a chance, get that book by Joseph Pierce, Literature, What Every Catholic Should Know, and you can go online probably and find it, or at a bookstore, or you can go over to the Dwelling Place here in Normal and Catholic bookstore and get it there. So there are a lot of places you can get it. It's a short book, and it will help you understand great literature. Easy to read. Joseph Smith is a very good writer, and you'll get the gist of some of the greatest pieces of literature, Western literature, you know, in history. and you'll get a little synopsis and get the core of it, the gist of it, very easy to read, and give you a great understanding of literature. So it's a nice little book to have, Joseph Pierce Literature, what every Catholic should know. But going
it
on,
is very readable. He's an author that you can read for the ordinary person can read and not have to have a dictionary with them to understand what he's trying to get across.
Yeah. But anyway, Dante wrote, you know, the Divine Comedy, and he refers back to an earlier character, Virgil, and Virgil travels through the three parts of the Divine Comedy, of course, are the Inferno and the Purgatorio and the Paradiso. In other words, going from hell to purgatory to paradise. And traveling through, and you're learning, you know, as you're traveling through what, you know, different parts of hell and, you know, what they represent. There's a lot of allegory in it, of course. And the fact is that in the Divine Comedy, most people, and we'll get to that, focus on the Inferno, and we'll get to some of the reasons why that's the case. But when we say, I want to talk about, you know, Dante and Virgil, and we'll do that as we go along, but when we talk about Divine Comedy, what does that mean when we call it Divine Comedy? Is the book a comedy? A ha ha ha, you know, funny. Is Virgil's story funny or what, Lynn?
Not in the least. It's not funny. But if you take it as a whole, from the, if you could picture yourself like having made it to heaven or being, you know, from God's point of view, these people struggle through all this stuff when all they have to do is turn to Him in the first place. So that becomes, to me, a comedy. Of how human nature just fights against everything.
Yeah, we're using comedy here in the classical sense, you know, in the Latin classical sense, as opposed to tragedy. In tragedy, you have a good man, you know, who is basically good. You have goodness being marred, usually by one tragic flaw, and there's a great fall, you know, at the end of the play or the work of literature. At the end of it, there's a fall. And in the divine, in something that's a comedy, it is the resolution. It could even be a sad resolution and so forth. But nevertheless, the resolution is in such a way that it is a, in a sense, a triumph. It doesn't mean comedy at all in the ha-ha sense. It's, you know, very dramatic. And, you know, many of Shakespeare's works were not all tragedy. Some of them could be considered comedies. And that's what comedy meant back then. And it's important to know that because actually, there have been charges against one of the Catholic popes, and I can't remember his name, but I think it was, you know, in modern times, at least in the 1900s anyway, and probably the mid-1900s or so. I can't remember which one of the popes it was, but one of the popes upon his deathbed or near, you know, the end of his life commented on the fact that, you know, the comedy of his life would be over. And the way he said it, it was taken by many anti-Catholics to have meant that he was just, you know, acting out a facade or a farce, you know, that his whole life had simply been a comedy, that it was a pretense. But that's not at all what he was referring to. He was referring to the comedy of his life, meaning that, you know, the ups and downs of his life was coming to an end, and that whole his whole life was a comedy in the, you know,
in the struggle,
in the real sense of comedy, meaning that it would come to finally a, you know, a good conclusion. It was finally coming to its proper conclusion, and as all men hope and must. And it did not mean comedy in the sense of, you know, my life was a comedy in the sense that it wasn't real or it was fake or it was funny or it was just a pretense. So you have to be very careful when you read things that you understand, especially in reading good literature, what the words mean. And so if you don't know for sure, you're better off not speculating. It's just like taking the Bible. We take an English word and we speculate on it, because it's been translated into English, but it's being translated from other languages, and we lose the nuances of those languages, and we can be way off the mark by taking something out of the Bible, especially if we just take one passage, one sentence or two, and try to take it literally. It may not mean what we think it means at all, so it's something you have to be very careful with. But at any rate, let's move on and get into the Dante's Divine Comedy itself. And I'll start with Joseph Pierce's comments on it. He says, lovers of the great books argue interminably about which is the greatest. And, of course, you know, you can't settle those arguments. Among philosophers, the argument might focus on the relative merits of the works of Plato and Aristotle or of Augustine and Aquinas. Among lovers of literature, some will argue that Homer's epics are the greatest. Others, possibly, though perhaps less convincingly, that Virgil deserves the laurel. And then there are those who will insist that Shakespeare is as good as it gets. And I'm sort of one of those. I like Shakespeare. And yet, for Catholics, we can hardly leave Dante out of the discussion. From a purely Catholic literary perspective, he must surely stand supreme. He is to Catholic literature what Thomas Aquinas is to Catholic philosophy. If Thomas is rightly called the angelic doctor, might Dante deserve to be called the angelic poet? If this is so, we can say that Dante's Divine Comedy must be seen as an indispensable part of every good Catholic's reading list. The problem is that Dante's magnum opus, and magnum opus, of course, means greatest work, must be read with Catholic eyes and not with the eyes with which the modern reader so often reads it. And that's true of Shakespeare as well. I'm pretty convinced, and, you know, Joseph Pierce, I think, really solidly closes the argument on Shakespeare that he was Catholic. And if you don't read some of Shakespeare's plays through Catholic eyes, they may be good in the sense that they're enjoyable, but they're confusing. And if you read them through Catholic eyes, they make sense, especially Hamlet. The problem with the modern reading of the poem is that it tends to remain trapped in hell, never venturing forth into purgatory and paradise. This is a consequence of the way that Dante has been read and taught for decades, indeed for centuries. So the question is you know, why? Why is it that we remain focused on the inferno, that is hell, and not the other parts? Well, hell is interesting, of course, you know, in a way, and humans are attracted to it. But there are some other reasons as well. I'm going to go ahead and take a break here. We'll come back and we'll talk about why it is that the focus on Dante is on the inferno, that is hell, to the neglect of the other two parts of his great work. So we'll come back in a little bit and talk about that. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
We're all here. We've all been created by God, for one thing, and that is to become holy. And I think we kind of think holiness is one of those stiff-necked things that you do, you know. But it isn't. It's a very normal thing. Jesus acted very normal and human, though he was divine. He groaned when he heard from Mary and Martha that Lazarus was dead. And he must have smiled when Martha reminded him that he made dead 4 days. Can you imagine a woman trying to explain death to God? I would.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. We're back from our break. We're talking about Dante and the Divine Comedy from the book Literature, What Every Catholic Should Know by Joseph Pierce, a great book that every Catholic should get if you have a chance. It's a very, very easy book to read, and it's short, 200 pages, and it gives some of the great works of Western literature, and it makes it understandable, and you get the gist of them if you haven't read these things before. And so it's a great way to start learning a little bit about literature. And we've been talking about the Divine Comedy, Dante's magnum opus, his greatest work, and it's three parts. It's in the Inferno, the Purgatorio, and the Paradiso, and that means, you know, the hell and purgatory and heaven. And we're talking about why the focus always is, it seems like, whether it's in secular literature or in Catholic literature, the focus always seems to be on the Inferno, that is, about hell. One of the reasons, of course, that I mentioned is that hell is, you know, very interesting to people. It's different. And so that contributes. But there are other reasons. And Joseph Pierce goes on to list them. And he says, ever since the Reformation, it has been the tendency to teach and read the Inferno to the exclusion of the Purgatorio and the Paradiso. The reason is obvious enough. Protestants believed in hell, but not in purgatory. As for paradise, the Protestant idea of heaven precluded the hierarchy of the communion of saints, which Dante presents in his comedy. Since Dante's purgatory and paradise were considered to be heretical, the Protestants were left with nothing but his hell in which to wallow. Disagreeing with Dante about the nature of the divine light, the Protestants could at least agree with him with regard to the darkness, which is the consequence of its absence. The tendency to read the Inferno to the exclusion of the Purgatorio and the Paradiso was continued by the children of the self-named Enlightenment. And you can see here that Joseph Pierce doesn't have too much positive thought about the Enlightenment. He calls it the self-named Enlightenment. And I had a guest on our show here a while back, a few times, and he calls the Enlightenment the Darkenment. And I have a tendency to agree that the Enlightenment was sort of like a self-named thing by people who thought that they were enlightened but weren't so enlightened. As the world is turning out, they weren't so enlightened after all. But at any rate, the Reformation was actually a Catholic thing, not a Protestant thing. It was the Catholic Church that reformed itself, but the Protestants left the Catholic Church, and those are facts that we should look at and not to cast any bad, you know, on people today. But nevertheless, back at the time of the Reformation, it was not a Protestant, really, Reformation. They didn't reform the church. They left the church. And the church reformed, the Catholic Church reformed itself. And it's constantly reforming itself all the time, as any human institution must. But let's go on. Whereas the skeptic-souled secularists might not believe in hell any more than they believed in purgatory or heaven, they could at least see that evil existed, even if they no longer called it sin, and they could perceive its harmful consequences. As such, the Inferno still resonated psychologically, even if its theology was now ignored. And he's talking here, of course, about, you know, the modern times after the Enlightenment, we seem to have, you know, cast out the whole idea of sin. There isn't any such thing. Somehow or another, it's either some kind of a psychological problem, or it's no problem at all, or what we used to call sin is now somehow called good. So things have sort of been turned topsy-turvy. But nevertheless, there is still evil, and so therefore modern people can look at the Inferno and get a lot out of it because there are bad guys there, and it's fun to, you know, cast stones at bad guys. It might be argued that none of the foregoing is of much concern to Catholics. If the Protestants and secularists want to wallow in Dante's hell because they have excluded themselves from purgatory and heaven, that is their problem. And I think Joseph Pierce here is being a little bit harsh, but I can understand why when you look at some of the bragging of the, it seems that modernism, that somehow or another we have these capabilities of solving all of the problems that have existed in the past, that now we're here, and therefore we have all the answers. He says, of what concern is it to us? The problem is that even the Catholic schools are often stuck in hell, having excluded themselves from purgatory and heaven. It is sad but true that only Dante's Inferno is on the curriculum at many otherwise good Catholic schools. And again, he asks, why is this? Well, in part, it is because we have bought the Protestant and secularist misperception that the Inferno is far superior to the other two books of the Commedia. This is quite simply not the case. It was not the view of the poet who composed it, nor of those who understand the poem best. Take, for instance, the judgment of Maurice Baring, one of the most cultured and well-read men of the last century. And he says, scaling the circles of the Paradiso, we are conscious the whole time of an ascent, not only in the quality of the substance, but in that of the form. It is a long, perpetual crescendo, increasing in beauty until the final consummation in the very last line. Somebody once defined an artist as a man who knows how to finish things. If this definition is true, and I think it is, then Dante was the greatest artist who ever lived. His final canto is the best, and it depends on and completes the beginning. And that's certainly true. You get that so much, as we said, way back in Homer, when he starts out his poem. You know, he starts out the Iliad with the first line, you know, captures the whole poem. This story is about the anger of Achilles and its devastation, you know, the devastation that it worked, and also the will of Zeus, you know, which was done. And the last line, if you look at the Iliad, completes that. In other words, the artist knows what he's doing, he knows where he's going, he lays out his course, and then he gets there, and then he wraps it up, and he wraps it up with finesse. And that's exactly what Baring here is saying that Dante is able to do. But at any rate, having seen through the lie, or at least the misconception born of ignorance, that the Inferno is superior to the other two books of the Commedia, why, one wonders, do some Catholic schools still not teach the Purgatorio and the Paradiso? An all too common reason is that the teachers are only teaching what they were taught. And that's true also. I mean, if you're only taught a certain thing, you sort of stick to it. Since those who teach were only taught the Inferno, they only know the Inferno. It is therefore easier to stay in one's own comfort zone, in this case, ironically, hell, rather than venture forth into an unknown and uncharted territory. And I guess heaven is sort of unknown and uncharted more than hell is. It seems like we can create hell on earth, but we can't seem to get the knack of creating heaven on earth. Literally, if not literally, literally, the path of least resistance for many Catholic teachers leads to hell. And what is worse, having led there, it stays there. And I think Joseph Pierce is having a little bit of fun here with these words and the fact that he's talking about the Catholic schools staying in hell. And I think maybe he's throwing sometimes a little bit of criticism on the church itself there, and sometimes it deserves it. A final reason for sometimes only teaching the Inferno is that there is simply not enough time to teach the whole Commedia. Sadly, this is usually true, and it is. I mean, you can't teach everything. And yet, if this is so, why not teach the Purgatorio or the Paradiso and not the Inferno? Well, then you'd be excluding, of course, one thing for the other, as what's happening now. So he goes on, Joseph Pearson. He says, better still, why not select certain cantos from each of the three books, thereby giving at least a sense of the majesty and integrity of the whole work. And so the students would have a sampling, you know, from each of them. And that's probably the best solution. And Pearson, I think, gets over his little myth here at the church and maybe at some of our history. And not just I'm not saying our Catholic history here, but the history of, you know, the history as it happened, the Enlightenment and so forth. And he's coming to a sensible solution. He goes on, regardless of the degree to which the world is only at home in hell, it is imperative that Catholics assent to the ascent, which leads from hell. So he's saying that we, you know, ascent, meaning we agree with the, you know, rising, the upward path which leads from hell, via Mount Purgatory, into the celestial sphere of paradise. Where else should Catholics seek to be in the presence of God and his saints? And then it's like, you know, be a saint. What else is there that we hear so much all the time on Catholic Spirit Radio? Why accept anything less, still less, the ultimate less, which is God's infernal absence? And he goes on. He says, although the Divine Comedy is possibly the greatest poem ever written, it is not without its problems, or dare one say flaws, especially in the way that the poet consigns real-life people to hell. And that's one thing that Dante does. Is he not committing the sin of detraction against these people? Is he not causing scandal by putting popes and other known people in hell? What are we supposed to do with this? Just ignore it or call it poetic license? And this reminds me, Lynn, of some American poetry. We have Edgar Lee Masters' Spoon River Anthology, which is set right down here in Petersburg, Illinois, right not far from the Spoon River. The Spoon River is just north of there, comes into the Illinois River up across from Havana. and Masters uses the word Spoon River. Actually, he's writing mostly about people along the Sangamon River, and he disguises it a little bit, but the disguise is pretty thin, and he puts a lot of characters into his Spoon River anthology who actually lived down there in Petersburg and along the Sangamon in that area. And some of those people got very, very angry because when the book came out, when the book, you know, poetry came out, these people were recognizable, at least to each other, you know, to the people that knew each other. And then some things were not so good. And they sort of ran Edgar Lee Masters out of town. And one guy, as far as I've heard, I think this is true from what I've read, kept a pistol on hand saying that if he ever came back into town, he'd shoot him, you know.
Yeah.
Well, this is...
He opened the door to the closet where things that had been hidden, people thought, were exposed. Yeah. They weren't happy.
That's for sure. And probably everybody in town knew some of these things, but nevertheless, the people didn't like them being brought out there where everybody could see them. And they were not too happy about it at all. So this is what Dante did. He brought some people of his time into hell. He brought one of the, I think, popes, actually, who had been declared a saint into hell, at least in the very outer fringes of hell. And, you know, that caused a lot of disturbance because, for one thing, he's implying that the church somehow was wrong and giving this person sainthood. So we have this in our, you know, right here in Illinois. And if you want to go down to Petersburg, you can see the cemetery there where a lot of the people were buried. This is the cemetery that Edgar Lee Masters is actually referring to. He talks about the hill in Spoon River anthologies, and he's talking about the cemetery that's on the hill right down there in Petersburg. And we also have Edwin Robinson, I'm not sure, I'm just going from memory here, one of our other American poets who also invented a town, I think, in upstate New York called Tilbury Town, and he has characters also that are real, peopling that town, and, you know, people from in that area, I guess, would be able to recognize some of the people, you know, in the town. And so this is putting real people into your story, and sometimes that can cause problems. And you have to answer these questions. You know, what do we do with this? And Dante, is this right? Should we, you know, actually put real people in? I mean, after all, you know, does the poet really know for sure exactly what the story is about these people, or is it just the poet's opinion? This is not exactly a court case where there's a trial and people get both sides of the question answered properly. So there are, you know, real questions to answer if it's right or wrong for literary people to do this kind of thing. But it's been done, and these are not the only examples, Dante and then the two that I gave. I'm sure there are others, you know, throughout literature where this happens, and it can be very, very uncomfortable for people who get stuck in there and know that other people recognize who they are, and maybe their side of the story is different. So,
that's human nature, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But it says, our discomfort with what might be termed Dante's judgmentalism is understandable. None of us should presume that anyone is in hell. And that's true. We don't know. It is fair, therefore, to question this aspect of Dante's approach. In his defense, we might suggest that he wanted to avoid writing a crudely formal allegory about the deadly sins, which would have been the case had he presented them as personified abstractions. And if I remember correctly about the Pope he has in hell, I think it was Pope Celestine.
I think you're right.
And it's a political, yeah, and it's a political thing. I think Dante put the Pope in hell because Dante considered that he was on the wrong side of politics, which is an entirely different thing from being a bad Pope. I mean, there were popes who probably are in hell. We can't say. But I mean, they were popes, they abused their office and did all kinds of bad things. But I don't think Celestine might have been one of those. So it was, you know, political. So that's another problem. You know, and of course, politics is still with us today. And it seems like we have a huge division in this country more than ever before over politics. And you can imagine what would happen if people started writing literature and sticking various politicians and other people into that literature, you could have some real fights and arguments going on, which you probably had back at that time. So in putting real people in hell and purgatory, it enlivens his story, bringing it to life literally. He is therefore employing poetic license. Whether this is sufficient reason for the crime of judgmentalism is, however, questionable. And he is actually, I think, Joseph Pierce here is having, he is sort of using this word crime of judgmentalism and judgmentalism a little bit maybe sarcastically, because we have this constant today, it seems like, being accusations of someone being judgmental. And, of course, you can't not be judgmental. When you call somebody else judgmental, you are making a judgment. We're making a judgment right now about Dante. If we come to a conclusion that he should or shouldn't have done this, or even that it's questionable, we're making judgments. You can't avoid it. Human beings can't avoid making judgments. So the question of is it a good judgment or a bad judgment? That's the question we have to answer, I think, in this case. But at any rate, we're going to go ahead and take a break here. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
We want the blood of Jesus to cover me. Why? Because we're sinners. The blood of Jesus shed on the cross healed all our wounds. It doesn't mean by that. A lot of people say, well, I can do what I want. I can commit any sin. Jesus saved me. You can't be presumptuous. God, holy God, cannot allow you to sin or give you the right to sin by dying for you. That doesn't make any sense.
Catholic Radio, changing hearts and minds.
I started listening to the Catholic radio a few months ago. I guess I'm a little hypocritical right now because I'm not Catholic, and it just makes my day go by so much faster. I love the spiritual family that you have. I just think it's so awesome.
We depend on your support to keep Catholic Spirit Radio on the air 24 hours a day, broadcasting the truth and beauty of the Catholic Church.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio, 89.5 FM and 92.5 FM in good old McLean and Bloomington Normal, McLean County and Bloomington Normal, and also down in Lincoln and also up in Pontiac, broadcasting to all of Central Illinois. And we're talking today about literature, whatever Catholics should know, from a book by Joseph Pierce of that name, and it's a great book and tells a lot about great literature in a way that's easily readable. We're talking about Dante, and we're talking about one of the problems with his Divine Comedy, the Inferno, the Purgatorio, and the Paradiso, is that he put actual people in it, and he had Pope Celestin, and here I hear he's talking here, he says, I'll go to this, he consigned St. Celestin V, it is, to the vestibule of hell for what he terms Celestin's great refusal to accept and embrace the papal office. Although Dante does not name Celestin V directly as the coward who made the great refusal, it has been accepted by most critics that Celestin was indeed the cowardly soul whom he singles out for his scorn. So Dante doesn't like Celestin for something that is actually political in Dante's time. It seems that Dante vents his spleen against Celestin, not so much for his resignation per se, I guess Celestin resigned the papacy, but for the fact that his resignation had enabled Dante's enemy, Boniface VIII, to become pope. So this is what Dante was angry about. And of course, we've had something similar to that to this day. We've had Benedict resigned. And so these things continue to go on. But Dante put this problem right into his poem, and of course it would have raised all kinds of sides and questions and people opposed and for each other back at that time. And had we done something like this today, let's say in a piece of literature or some kind of work today with the popes that we have right now, it would raise the same kind of storm that went on back then. And Pierce goes on, he says, "It is, however, imperative that we not allow this tragic flaw in Dante's comedy to blind us to the beauty of the great poet's engagement with sin in hell and purgatory, with repentance in purgatory, and with sanctity in heaven. It is a majestic work filled to the brim with Christian insight into man's relationship with God and neighbor. In short, we should not allow the mote in Dante's eye to become the plank in ours. Before we leave our discussion of Dante's Divine Comedy, we should also address the thorny question of which edition should be read. The present author strongly recommends either of two editions. The first is the Dorothy L. Sayers translation, that's Penguin Classics, and the other is the more recent translation by Anthony Esselin, Modern Library Classics. A single strength of the Sayers translation is its adherence to Dante's original terza rima, the rhyme scheme that Dante invented for the poem. This verse stanza form, consisting of the interlocking three-line stanzas connected in a single canto-linked chain, is formally robust and conveys a cohesive strength to the fabric of the work. Something integral to the poem is lost when the terza rima is abandoned by translators. The problem is that it is much easier to find words that rhyme in Italian than it is in English, making terza rima difficult to render from the one language into the other." And that's one thing I think that we should remember all the time, is that when you are translating from one language to another, you often lose much. You lose nuances, and you cannot sometimes convey the exact meaning. I mean, you just don't have the time to explain, you know, that a word has certain nuances and certain meanings and can be used in different ways in a language than it is, say, in another language. And so translations are always problematic. And we should be very careful in reading the Bible, because we're reading something that's been translated from the Greek, and that has often, you know, been translated from Hebrew and translated, you know, from other languages that people spoke back at that time. And unless you're really good at understanding the whole thing in those languages, you can make serious mistakes simply by taking a sentence or two, I think I mentioned this before, out of context, and, you know, you're talking about something of which you may not have the right meaning at all. So be very, very careful about that. And sometimes, you know, people do this. They take something out of the Bastari. One of the examples I can think of, Lynn, is that we always refer to, Mary's cousin Elizabeth, don't we?
Yes.
She went to visit, you know, in the visitation. She
her
went
kinsman.
To visit her cousin Elizabeth.
Yeah, kinswoman.
But right, the word cousin, you know, that we use, it was not necessarily her cousin.
No.
Because even if they used the word that meant cousin, or some circumlocution that meant cousin, cousin didn't necessarily mean the same thing. I mean, they called people who were close to them by all kinds of closer names that we use for only specific relatives. I mean, they call people brothers who were not really their brothers. They call people sometimes cousin or family who were not really, you know, blood related and that kind of thing, because they had a different culture. And so we have to be very, very careful about that.
Yes, so you have to keep in mind, in different cultures throughout the world, even today, that terms are used to describe people in different ways and they mean different things. So keep that in mind. You know, for instance, the feminine or the, you know, masculine side of things will have different endings.
Exactly. And, you know, some languages have a lot of what we call gender. You know, in other words, various words in that language are either female or else they're male or else they're neutral. And in English, of course, we don't have much what we call gender at all. And gender really, for the most part, doesn't really refer to persons in most languages. And even in English, it doesn't. It refers usually to things. Like, for example, in English, you do have a gender for a ship. A ship is called she, so we have gender there. It's female. A ship is female. A gun is usually called she, and that's female. But we have very, very little of that in English. Some languages have a lot of it. You have to know, you know, all the various words have a particular gender assigned to them. And so gender in most languages, and even in English, doesn't mean what people think it means. Yeah. It just means male or female as assigned to a particular thing or object. People don't have to have it because usually people, you know, in other words, you know if a person is male or female or a dog or a cat is male or female by the way the story is told or the author's description or you're just told that. But in other words, you have to know that it's considered feminine or masculine or whatever the case might be.
Right. And in Russian, I did read Anna Karenina, and there are different endings just to their name. Contonates what relationship they are to the speaker. And at first, it's hard to keep that in mind when you read.
And then things change. I mean, even in our language, I think the word cousin has taken on a different meaning than it used to take many, many years ago. Many, many years ago, cousin was pretty well, you meant, you know, your blood relation, you know, your father's, brother's son or whatever the case might be. But in modern, a cousin is taken on, you know, you have places called like Cousin Fred's or something like that, and it's a place of business, and meaning that the guy is, you know, you should think of him like your cousin, you know, this businessman. You can trust him, he's your cousin. Or you say, what's buzzing, cousin, and stuff like that, you know, to friends and other people. And so if people read that didn't understand our culture at the modern times, they could be very confused as about what the word cousin means. So you got to be careful.
That's right.
So that's a little aside there, I guess. But you get so much of that. You get people arguing and fighting over something in the Bible, and here either both don't know what it means, or at least one of them doesn't know what it really means, and they take it literally, or they, you know, at face value when it means something else entirely because they're taking it out of context. And even if it's read in context, there are still nuances that you don't get. So you have to be really careful. And you have to do that, you know, when you read a translation of great literature. It's not going to be the same exactly as it was in the original language. It's just impossible to do. It says, another strength of these two particular editions is the quality of the explanatory notes. It is simply not possible for a modern reader to fully appreciate Dante's work without frequent reference to the accompanying notes. And it's the same with a lot of older, Chaucer or any of them. If you don't have notes with it, you're not going to know what some of the words and sentences mean. The quality of such notes is therefore crucial. Especially important is the manner in which the notes conform with Dante's Thomistic and understanding of the cosmos and man's place within it. Sayers is especially good at making that connection. And it's important when you're reading literature, you know, if you really get into it, to understand a poet or a writer's what we call cosmology. That is, his philosophy of the universe or his philosophy of religion. I mean, how does he look at the world and the universe? And so if you go back in time, you're going to find a different look at it than probably you would find with a modern person today. Says,
right, because we aren't really aware of just what was going on at the time and whether they were mocking, for sure, whether they're mocking somebody or not.
Exactly. So that's why it's great to read something like this. You get the gist of it. And then if you ever want to get into it, you probably would be better off reading something that gives you a good introduction to the work. You know, some short work that is titled something like An Introduction to Dante or something like that. And stick with that. Don't try to get into something that, you know, you can't, you know, fully understand. Any diligent reader seeking to do some further background reading as a means of delving deeper into the Commedia could do far worse than to consult The Passionate Intellect, Dorothy L. Sayers' Encounter with Dante, by Barbara Reynolds, Kent State University Press, 1989. Dr. Reynolds was a close friend of Sayers. It was she who finished Sayers' translation of the Paradiso after Sayers had died in the midst of the work. She is therefore uniquely placed to guide us into a deeper encounter with his greatest of poets. And that's what you should probably read is, you know, someone else who really understands writes a book explaining the poem that you're in question. It's better to approach it that way than just try to read it by yourself. And one parting thought. It is an intriguing fact that the Italian language has moved in slow motion in its development over the centuries, at least as compared to English. For this reason, Dante's Italian is much closer to modern Italian than, for instance, is Chaucer's English to modern English. In fact, Dante is as easy to read in the original, if one knows Italian, as is Shakespeare's English to a modern English reader, even though Shakespeare is writing 300 years after Dante. Shakespeare is writing in the 300s, and or I mean 1500s, and Dante in the 1200s, and therefore 300 years closer to us in time. This intriguing fact is mentioned because those who speak Italian might want to try reading the poem in the original tongue in which it was written, which is always best. Might it even be suggested that it is worth learning Italian simply to be able to enjoy this most wonderful of poets in the language in which he writes?
And indeed, that's probably true, but I can't see myself doing it.
That's a big suggestion, but for some people who really love literature and are young enough, you know, maybe...
And have the time
Or are older and have the time and they want to do something like this, it would be, you know, something that, you know...
I'm sure it would be very satisfying.
You could take on, it would be satisfying. There's so much, you know, to find and read in some of these works, and you learn a lot, you know, of course, about the time, and some of these people brought a lot of their own politics and so forth into question. And so we're going to go ahead and stop with the Joseph Pierce's literature right here at this point, because the next thing we're going to get into is Chaucer. And we're going back to English again. We were back at Beowulf, and Beowulf was written around the 700 or 800s. We're not exactly sure. Chaucer, of course, we know was written. Chaucer lived from 1343 to 1400 in England. And so we know exactly the period it was written in. We know a lot, you know, about Chaucer, and we know a lot about, you know, the time that he was writing and about the church and the area that he was in and everything else. So when we approach Chaucer, we're approaching it from an understanding of our own culture a little bit better, because much of this culture was brought, you know, from England to the United States. Chaucer, of course, was Catholic, and England was still Catholic during Chaucer's time. Chaucer lived, of course, at the end of the Middle Ages, not at the beginning, you know, of the Middle Ages. And the Middle Ages was changing over to modern times. And when we say Shakespeare's English is more, you know, understandable to a modern person, there's a lot in Shakespeare modern people wouldn't understand, but you can read the language a little bit easier. Chaucer's is not that difficult. It's Middle English. It's Old English. You know, if you had to read Beowulf in its original language, you couldn't read it. You wouldn't know anything at all. I mean, it's more Germanic than anything else. You can read Chaucer. You'll see the English words there, but you won't know how they're pronounced. And, you know, some of the words, you won't know really exactly what they mean and that kind of thing. So it'll be interesting to approach Chaucer, and very interesting to leave Dante and come back over to English and our English history from, but for the church's purpose, I think everybody should have some smattering and understanding of Dante's works, the Inferno and the Purgatorio and the Paradiso, so the Divine Comedy. Anything more that you want to say on?
No, I think it's all very worthwhile reading. It does a lot for one in your knowledge and your understanding, both of what human nature is and relating it to God. Very important.
And when we get back to Chaucer next week, we'll be doing Chaucer. I'll be a little bit more on firmer ground. I have a greater understanding of Chaucer. You know, so of course, when I studied literature, we spent a lot more time on Chaucer and with Chaucer. After all, he's writing in English. And I had a great teacher for Chaucer who really understood the Middle English language very, very well, and really enjoyed it. Chaucer's just wonderful to read. His characters, yeah, he's sort of a...
He has a lot of satire in times.
Right, satire, and he's a, you know, prequel to Shakespeare in a way, because Shakespeare also had such a great understanding of people, and could really go deep and write on, you know, a lot of different levels. And Chaucer maybe doesn't go on the levels that Shakespeare does, but he has a great understanding of people, and he really gets at their natures and what they're like.
It really comes through when you read Chaucer.
It really
does.
His
understanding of human nature is right on.
And he's just fun to read. He really is. So at any rate, that's what we'll be doing next week. So we're going to go ahead and end our lesson on that note. And we'll be coming back next week and going further with Joseph Pierce's literature, What Every Catholic Should Know. I hope everybody out there is enjoying that. In the meantime, St. Michael, the Archangel, defend us in battle. Be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, we humbly pray. And do thou, Prince of the heavenly hosts, by the power of God, thrust into hell Satan and all evil spirits who wander through the world for the ruin of souls. Amen.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5. If you'd like to contact Bob, email bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Again, that's bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Catholic Spirit Radio relies on your support to bring programming like this and EWTN to Central Illinois 24 hours a day. Please help keep Catholic Spirit Radio on the air with your generous support. Donate online at catholicspiritradio.com or send a donation to Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. That's Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. Catholic Spirit Radio is a 501c3, and all donations are tax deductible. Thank you for your support of Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
You are infinitely loved by God. Are you really deeply convinced of this reality? Listen, before your spiritual and personal life can take off like a rocket, you must first come to a deep realization of the incredible personal love God has for you as an individual. You see, your Heavenly Father has been intimately cradling you your entire life. He will never leave you. Quote, "Listen to me, you who have been carried since birth, whom I have carried since the time you were born. In your old age, I shall still be the same. When your hair is gray, I shall still support you. I have already done so. I have carried you. I shall still support and deliver you." See Isaiah 46:3-4. I'm Jim Littleton, FormingFaithfulFamilies.com.
The Wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I think I got something here. It sounds kind of silly to me. I don't know if it sounds silly to you. Maybe I won't be able to find it, but this is one of those inclusive language things. We must give and totally commit ourselves to a life of love and love for our human sisters and brothers. What other kind of sisters and brothers? You can't get mad at a man like this. See, he got scrupulous. He didn't want to. He had to say sisters and brothers, but he had to admit they're human.